And it's KVC Arts Now on KVCR, Arts and Entertainment, as well as the people and places providing it. I'm David Fleming, and it's time for my annual visit with Al Petrelli, music director for and one of the guitarists with Trans-Siberian Orchestra. Trans-Siberian Orchestra has been touring since 1999, with the only exception being during the height of COVID. But even then, TSO recorded a concert live with no edits and presented that as a pay-per-view type of event. Now, over the last half dozen years or so, they've been rotating between performances of Christmas Eve and Other Stories and the Ghosts of Christmas Eve, originally created as a made-for-TV movie. This year, Trans-Siberian Orchestra is touring The Lost Christmas Eve, which was the third installment of their Christmas trilogy, which began with Christmas Eve and Other Stories and The Christmas Attic. The tour has them in the region once again, November 30th, and it's worth noting that they won't be in Ontario, as they have been for, well, as long as I can remember. Rather, they'll be at the Honda Center in Anaheim. And we'll be talking about The Lost Christmas Eve, and of course have music from the album. But we're going into this broadcast with something other than TSO, and this isn't really a severe departure, as every year Al and I wander in and out of Trans-Siberian Orchestra, often piggybacking on something that we spoke about the previous year or even in years past. He tends to remember the nuances that we discover in our conversation, so this year I started with a detour, with one of the gold standards for guitarists, Jeff Beck, with Stevie Wonder's Because We Ended as Lovers. I'm going to start with something away from TSO, and that is that, you know, as a recovering theater geek, I used to know that I was ready to go on stage with one role or another when I was not poring over the script and instead reading something else that I enjoyed. And I think that crosses over to you getting ready for a TSO performance. Often you're listening to something else. And one of the tunes that you and I have spoken about in the past is Because We've Ended as Lovers. Specifically the Jeff Beck version, and I have a hard time remembering, in all honesty, it's a Stevie Wonder tune.
Yeah.
But I spoke with a couple of guitar monsters in my recent past, Al Di Meola and Lee Ritenour, both.
Oh, God.
Oh, my God, yeah.
Joking.
Yeah, no.
Yes, yes, all day yes.
Yes, indeed. And so in my preparation with Ritenour, I found a version of him and Steve Lukather performing Because We've Ended as Lovers. And so that really just got me thinking about this interview with you. Have you ever recorded that anywhere? I know that's a tune that just moves you beyond belief.
I've never recorded it. There's certain things that to me are off limits because when it's a masterpiece musically and emotionally and how it was articulated, I ain't touching it.
Gotcha.
You know?
Yeah.
I love that song. I've played it 1,000 times in my life live. But there's no way that I would ever be able to bring it anywhere other than where Jeff Beck took it, in my opinion.
Gotcha.
You know?
Yep.
The same would go with his rendition that he did with Eric Clapton of Moon River.
Oh, my God.
You know?
Yeah.
There's just certain things that I listen to and go, I'm not touching this one, you know? It's just not going to happen. So, no, not for mere mortals like me. I remember Stevie Ray Vaughan doing a cover of Little Wing that I thought was breathtaking.
Yep.
And that's another song that you kind of don't want to play with too much. But Stevie Ray had the ability to take that and elevate it, not past, but certainly to a different place that Jimi Hendrix took it.
Yeah.
But when it comes to Jeff Beck, I'm real weird like that. I don't mess with his stuff ever. I learn it, I study it, I dissect it, analyze it, and just realize I'm never going to be that good, so why bother?
Wow. Wow. Okay, well, let's talk about TSO.
Sure.
The Lost Christmas Eve, oh yes. Now, musically, I'll be kicking off the show the same way that the album does, with one of my, forgive me for the word, one of my favorite mashups, Faith Noel. Mm-hmm. First Noel, O Come All You Faithful, such a searing way to go into this. That leads me to something about arrangements. I really started paying attention to arrangers because of Dave Bardoon. It was his arrangement for the Stan Kenton Orchestra of My Funny Valentine. Yeah. And I used to announce this when playing it on the air, a ballad that with this arrangement will blow your socks off in power and intensity. So with the Faith Noel in mind, or other tunes, my question, what happens to do this, to really blow people away with what is truly a soft song? It's got to go beyond a stronger, louder attack.
Well, when I was sitting in the studio with Paul, he'd come up with an idea. And then one of the many things I love about Paul is that he followed the Miles Davis theory. Mm-hmm. Surround yourself with talented people and let them speak their mind and see what comes up, you know? And a lot of these arrangements, he would come up with an idea. He goes, where do you want to take it next? How do you want to do this? And we would, you know, kind of either he had it all or I would contribute to the arrangement. But when it comes to the recording of it, he would tell me time and time again, I don't believe you. And I'm like, huh? I'm like, what? And he goes, you're playing notes. Now, put words behind the notes. Tell me the story. Go, you know, be vulnerable, you know. I tear those walls down and go to a place that's either dark or jubilant or whatever it is. You know, I need you to come out and be honest with this and people will relate to it. And that was the manner in which we pretty much approached everything, whether it was like a high-intensity song or more of a subdued song. But he wanted to have a certain, I don't want to say darkness to it, but maybe a bittersweet feel to it, you know, because not everybody is jubilant around the holidays. You know, a lot of times it's a sad holiday for people if you're missing somebody.
Sure. Wow. That darker look, that may apply to a... Well, the Christmas canon, but I'll ask about that one a little bit later. But that's...
Let me just throw this thought in. Just make
please.
Me think of something. I love talking to you like this because we go down, you know, music alley together. Mm-hmm. But it's not too different. I've re-explored Wayne Shorter's sax solo and melody on a remark he made off the Heavy Weather album.
I'm sure
you're familiar with that.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, as a kid, you know, listen, it was like Jocko and Wayne Shorter and Joe Zawinul and Pete Erskine and the whole bunch. And, you know, fantastic work. And I remember listening to that song 50 years ago. And being moved by the song. And I was like, wow, that's really deep. And I never paid any more attention to it until I stumbled upon it again and I wanted to analyze it because Wayne Shorter's approach to the scale and the pentatonics and his melody choice was very different than anything I would do as a guitar player. And I'm always exploring horn players and different instrumentalists because I want to get a different vantage point from, you know, how do they hear things? Anyway, the long and the short of it is that around that same time, I was going through, like, I don't know, what do you call it, Amazon Prime stuff and Netflix and all this, and I saw a documentary about Wayne Shorter.
Yeah.
Like, cool. Anyway, he ends up talking about the entirety of his career, fascinating, his tenure with Miles, whatever, and he talks about the making of that record, and his daughter had passed away before he recorded that song. And I went back and listened again, and I go, that's why. You know, he didn't have anything to say publicly about that, but he said everything in the way that he articulated every one of those notes. And I could never put my finger on why this is like touching me in such a way, why I really fell in love with his tone, his restraint, his discipline, yet it was so moving. And I was like, wow, and there it is right there.
Wow. He really brought, whether or not he was meaning to, this Stanislavskian approach, this drawing from inside personal experiences to add to it. Oh my God, wow.
I think I mentioned to you, and maybe I didn't mention to you, and if I did, just cut me off and say you know the story. But even when I was working with Alice Cooper years and years and years ago, you know, and we were in doing what was to become the Hey Stupid record, and Desmond Child, wonderful, incredibly talented songwriter, was producing it, and he kept stopping me when I was doing a solo, you know. And he wasn't necessarily being that pleasant about it, you know, but it didn't matter. He was, like, cutting me off, and I looked at him like, what? And he goes, you have got to drop the Italian Brooklyn bravado and be okay with being vulnerable in the studio in front of me, because I need you to go somewhere dark, wherever, painful, in order to have a solo that means something to my song. Mm. And he goes, when you're ready to be vulnerable, then we can commence recording again. Until then, go away.
Wow.
And I was like, you know, my immediate reaction at like 26 years old was like, really? And then I thought about it, and that was like one of the most important lessons I've ever learned. I got to be secure enough with opening up and being vulnerable to the song to say what I need to say regarding that. Otherwise, it'll never seem real.
That's incredibly true. I've noted musicians in the past, instrumentalists, you know, like Benny Carter or whomever, that would talk about how you really needed to know the lyrics to a tune if you were going to play the instrumental properly.
Yeah.
So that's
exactly.
Yeah.
Because we're telling a story. You know, not too different than, you know, Robert De Niro staying in character during Taxi Driver.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, method acting.
Yep.
You know, Lee Strasberg, that whole school of that generation of actors who were like some of the greatest actors of our time. But like, they became the characters. They were not portraying a character, they became the character.
Yes.
And Paul used to tell me that all the time. You know, the singers, I don't want them singing the lyrics, I want them telling the story like it was their story. Yeah, and with me, I didn't have the luxury of the English language or the spoken word to tell my story. I had to go find a dark, deep place and be okay with that. You know, and it's really interesting because you have to have a really, really trusting relationship for the person in which you're doing that in front of or with. You know, you're not going to do that with a stranger. You know, you got to be okay, and you have to trust that person, and then you learn to do it when you need to do it.
Wow, really, it's something that comes out more, and people will, I guarantee, now go back to other pieces, whether it's your stuff, TSO material, or just other pieces. They're going to be going back with a different ear because of this conversation. That is totally cool.
I remember a long, long time ago when I first recorded Oh Holy Night off the first record.
Oh, yes.
You know, and I did a pretty good job, you know. I still listen to them. Yeah, not bad. But I remember a friend of mine coming up to me, said, hey, I heard that song. And I'm like, oh, okay, cool. They're like, wow, you really don't like Christmas. You're
what?
Really sad. And I'm like, ooh, okay. And, you know, and maybe at that part of my life, maybe I was sad about it. Who knows? But, you know, it's funny how people pick up on those are the subtle things. That's what I concentrate on as a musician. Not the amount of notes, not the quantity of notes, but what can I say within a very few ingredients? And I find that a much more daunting task to be able to pull off properly.
Most certainly. Most certainly. And that's, I don't know whether it's very much like what we would call the 12 percenters. You know, it's the little things that everybody will enjoy, but a small portion, like that 12%, will truly, truly appreciate it on a deeper, utmost level. And it's a bonus for them.
Yeah, agreed, well put. And the other 88% of the people may not tangibly understand why, they just know that this is good. Or
yes.
The opposite.
Yeah.
This is not good.
Yeah.
You know?
Wow. You're listening to KVC Arts. I'm David Fleming. On this edition of KVC Arts, I'm speaking with Al Petrelli with Trans-Siberian Orchestra. They'll be at the Honda Center in Anaheim this year, touring The Lost Christmas Eve, one they haven't performed in quite some time.
On the street in the night, in the cold winter's light, a child stands alone and she's waiting. And the light that's out there, it just hangs in the air. As if it was just hesitating, and the snow it comes down, and it muffles the sound of dreams on their way to tomorrow. And when they appear, this night will hold them near, for where they will lead, it will follow. For here in this city of lights, this evening awakens the dreams that it might. The winter it conjures, the spells it will weave, so gently covers the ground, Christmas Eve.
The Lost Christmas Eve, we've had a couple of other shows in rotation for the last several tours. As with the other two shows, this has a familiar, wonderful theme of loss and redemption. The story, though, I think is quite different. in the main vehicle, or the protagonist, if you will. So if you would please, let's hear the storyline for this, The Lost Christmas Eve, a new one for some folks.
As we get to that, one of the fascinating things about this record is that we haven't done it in its entirety in about a dozen years. But some of the songs on that have become the audience's favorite pieces, some of the most popular songs we've ever done. So we've been doing these songs in the set every year, just not tied into the story. And the long and the short of the story, the two sentiments that I walk away from, and you tell me before we get into the nuts and bolts of the story, tell me if you agree with me.
Mm-hmm.
One is the sentiment of it's never too late.
Yes.
Okay. Now, in the case of the father and his child, pretty much half a lifetime goes by until he finds out that I'm going to go reach out to my boy and make up for lost time, or at least forget about making up for lost time, at least have a life together. It's never too late to start something like that. It's never too late to reach out to somebody that you've lost touch with. It's never too late to right or wrong, whatever that may be. The other thing that I walk away from being a parent and writing some of the songs on this, especially the song Different Wings, you know, I was just playing, you know, an acoustic guitar on the couch in the studio, and, you know, I love waltzes, you know. I just love the way that they feel almost like always a lullaby, like Edelweiss, right?
Mm, yeah, nice.
And Paul started humming something. Oh, yeah, that's pretty. What do you got? And then he came out with a Child with Different Wings lyric, and I'm like, nailed it. And then he completed the lyric, and we recorded the song. And what I noticed about that is that you have a child who's obviously different due to the complications at birth,
yes,
right? And we're programmed to fear differences. You know, I'm not going to get on a political or any kind of bandwagon or bandstand about any of that. But people who are different, we're kind of afraid of, for whatever the reason. Until you find, in a lot of cases, like the beauty behind the differences, culturally, religiously, socially, whatever it is. And that's like kind of my hidden meaning inside the story of like, here is a father who goes through his life, you know, resenting a situation, you know, and his son is different and his son's never going to be like all the other sons. Yet when he finally realizes it's never too late to explore what's going on, he realizes that his son is so much more special because he's different.
Yes.
Dream child, stars have been rumored to see dreams within newborn eyes.
The other two stories, it's really so much about, oh, I don't know, there was a disagreement or whatever. A child runs away or is lost and they're wanting to get home. But this, we're talking about a period of, 40 years or more between having to give your child up. So much different than a spat and then running away to wherever else. This is actually giving up your child to an orphanage or whatever it was.
Sure, state hospital.
Yeah, yeah, that's what it was, yes.
Yeah. And you know how permanent that decision was until it wasn't, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And literally, you know, from infancy to adulthood, and the regret and the anger and the pain that the father was carrying. You know, listen, anger is a really heavy thing to carry around for a long period of time.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and for whatever the reason, and circuitously during the journey of the story, he just makes the decision to, okay, I'm done with this. I don't have the wherewithal to be angry any longer. And for me, like, I'm approaching 62 years old next week, you know, and not in a morose manner or way, but, you know, I have a lot more yesterdays than I got tomorrows.
Yeah, know what you're saying.
You know what I mean, dude? I'm not wasting a second on anything. If I can undo something, I'm going to do it. If there's something I want to say, I'm going to say it. If I want to walk into my daughter's bedroom four times in the middle of the night because I just want to get one more look at her, give her one more kiss while she's sleeping. I'm doing it.
Mm.
You know? Nice. And in the case of The Lost Christmas Eve, what did Paul tell me once that was really just kind of like eye-opening? He was quoting somebody, I don't remember whom, but they said that their definition of hell was to die and meet the person you could have become.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And I was like, wow, that's never happened to me. You know? Whether it's what I could have become, what I should have said, what I should have done, what I could have, I'm not checking out like that, you know?
Yeah.
And the other thing about it, and, you know, that's why I love these detailed conversations that you and I have. A lot of people in the audience, and I think I mentioned it to you last time we chatted about Leonard Bernstein's quote regarding Beethoven.
Yes.
About art has to be accessible but never ordinary.
Right.
Well, here we are again.
Yeah, indeed.
Right? The story has to be accessible. Otherwise, you know, it's like me watching 2001 Space Odyssey when I was a kid. I don't get it, you know?
The first 28 minutes.
Yeah. Well, whatever Stanley Kubrick was trying to say back then went over my head at 11 years old. Whatever. Doesn't matter.
Yeah.
But the folks in our audience will not only understand the story, but they can apply the story to themselves.
Mm-hmm. One of the tunes that we talked about from past shows and past tours, Wizards in Winter, this is one that we get on The Lost Christmas Eve, and though, again, getting it on other tours, this is just a great way to energize the crowd. One of the openers, I feel, and I think that it would get your, personally, adrenaline up as well. I feel like that there are moments in Wizards in Winter which are reminiscent of something that I can't quite put my finger on. So I want to go to some of the ones that I can put my finger on or found notes on with regard to The Lost Christmas Eve. This comes from, my German is worse than my Portuguese, but it's from one of the arias from Mozart's Magic Flute.
Yeah. And Magic Flute, yes, absolutely.
And it's not just a reimagining. There's portions of it. And another one that I feel like hits the spirit, not so much a quoting of it. And we'll get to that in a bit. But yeah, Queen of the Winter Night.
You know, again, you're talking about a guy who, like, walked the streets of New York City, that relatively small piece of real estate, and was able to go from the Garden to Carnegie Hall to Radio City to Avery Fisher to the Met to any venue he wanted to see whomever he wanted. He was so well-versed in all the styles of music. He'd walk the theater district and be able to quote like so many different lines from so many different shows. You know, dude had it together. He was an absolute avid student of the arts. And I remember walking into the studio with him for one of the first times, and he goes, listen, I have a piece of music that I'd like to interject into one of these songs. And he put the chart in front of me. He goes, can you read them? I'm like, yeah, pretty well. And it was Mozart's 24th Symphony.
Okay.
And I wasn't familiar with that. I absolutely did not come from a classical background whatsoever. You know, with the exception of whatever show tunes were being played on TV, West Side Story, South Pacific, Jesus Christ Superstar, South Music, that was it.
Yeah.
That was as deep as I got into the classical world. And I'm reading it, I'm playing it, I'm like, well, how did you stumble upon this? He's like, oh, you know, I have all the symphonies. I listen to them all the time. And then, so anyway, when it came time to The Lost Christmas Eve, you know, he's like, we're going to do a Mozart piece. I'm like, you're killing me. You know, I'm actually going to have to work for a living today. And he had this arrangement in his head of the Magic Flute. And, you know, the arrangement was one thing. Finding somebody to sing it, that was a whole other problem.
Yes.
You know, that is no joke. To articulate those arpeggios at that tempo, good Lord Almighty. But again, Paul had a way of getting the best performance out of people that didn't even think that they could pull that one off. You know, and I was happy with that arrangement. It's like, when we played that live, like last year, we hadn't done that song in a long, long time, and we had one of the young ladies sing it, and little girls in the audience were watching this like grown woman sing a Mozart opera in the world's largest snow globe, effortlessly. And we're exposing another generation of young children to the great works of these great composers that maybe they wouldn't have stumbled upon, you know, during the day. The arts programs at school are a little suspect anyway, and I don't know if they're studying great composers. Right. But, you know, they got a dose of Mozart that night.
So much of our classical exposure comes from cartoons and whatnot.
Cartoons.
And early jazz, too, for that matter. Some of the Betty Boop stuff. Wow.
Well, listen, I watched the Tom and Jerry cartoons from when I was a kid very closely.
Yeah.
Or Fantasia, you know, all the Disney stuff, the early Disney stuff.
I mean,
maybe or maybe not, they were legit classical composers. I don't know, but they were certainly influenced by the great composers, you know. I listen to John Williams soundtracks, and so I can hear Holt's War of the Planets.
Yep, that's right.
Or if I listen to, you know, Leonard Bernstein, when he wrote Someday from West Side Story, you know, it was brought to my attention. If you listen very closely to, like, you know, Beethoven's Second Piano Concerto, you can hear the themes and the melodies or the harmony and the 2/5s running through that. It's like, wow.
That's right.
You know, we're all influenced by our predecessors. So I just never went back to the original well. I didn't start there, so it's not in my blood.
Gotcha. Okay. For this edition of KVC Arts, it's been music, for the most part, from Trans-Siberian Orchestra, in conversation with guitarist and music director Al Petrelli. A reminder that this year, their regional appearance lands in Anaheim at the Honda Center. The other significant change this year is the album they're touring, The Lost Christmas Eve. More at trans-siberian.com. And with that, we wrap up another edition of KVC Arts. Thanks again to Al Petrelli. Thanks also to Alan Rommelfanger for setting these conversations up year after year. Here at KVCR, thanks to Rick Dulock, Sandy Hodela, Zach Mays, and Shireen Awad. Be sure to check out our calendar of events at our homepage, kvcrnews.org, or you can go directly there at kvcrnews.org/calendar. Many past KVC Arts can be found through iTunes, NPR One, Google Podcasts, and Spotify, and most past shows are kvcrnews.org/arts. That includes past conversations with Petrelli, including a couple from October of last year when we had a very extended conversation about Petrelli's history beyond Trans-Siberian Orchestra. This was for my 500th episode, and that included his time with Alice Cooper, Asia, Dee Snider, some funk and fusion, and much, much more. Again, kvcrnews.org/arts for that conversation. That was divided into a 30-minute show and a separate special one-hour show as well. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support, which you can do any time of the year. Give at kvcrnews.org/support. And thanks again.